It is now my great pleasure to introduce our speaker for this morning, Rabbi Jeremy Parnes, who is the spiritual leader of the Beth Jacob Synagogue. Jeremy was educated in England, where he specialized in creative approaches to community development. His past involvement in the community service includes the chair of Habitat for Humanity, chairing the inner city and social housing committees, and reporting to the mayor's task force on housing, serving on Regina's Housing Advisory Committee, and chairing the Homelessness Committee. He was also the community facilitator of the Regina Inner City Community Partnership. Rabbi Parnes sat on a number of inner city boards, including Youth Connections and the Boys and Girls Clubs of Canada, and is a member of the Regina Multi-Faith Forum. Aside from his work within the Regina community, Jeremy is chair of the board of Aleph, the Alliance for Jewish Renewal, an international Jewish outreach organization. Welcome, Rabbi Parnes, or should I say welcome back, Rabbi Parnes.
Thank you. Can you hear me all right? I could go downstairs and have a coffee and still be talking. Good morning. Maybe I'll just stand out front here and visit. I like the lapel mic. It's great. Thank you. So I was asked to come this morning, and I'm delighted to be here, to speak about Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, or maybe the Day of At-One-ment, one might say. There's a number of ways we can do this. I can tell you about it, or you can ask questions, or we can do a bit of both. A bit of both? It's nice to have a conversation rather than be spoken at all the time, don't you think? So I'm happy to take your questions as you have them. Let me just say, is anyone familiar with Yom Kippur or the concept of Yom Kippur? Somewhat? Oh, yes. Okay. So I'll be brief. The Yamim Noraim, which are the days of awe, stretch from significantly from Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, to through to the end of Yom Kippur, and then the Chag, the festival of Sukkot, the festival of booths, follows from there. The whole process is about 6 weeks in its time frame, over which time it takes place. And for 30-some days before that, the month before Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, we actually take the time to go into introspection. So the idea is, if at nothing else, if no other time, and of course there are other times as well, but for sure at this time of year, the idea is to go into a process of how did we do individually in the year that just passed? And what could we do better? How can we reach forward to what we call tikkun, repair, making the world a better place? And so there's this period of introspection followed by the celebration of the Jewish New Year, where we don't normally make resolutions about weight loss, quitting smoking, or anything like that. Though it has more to do with how am I going to improve on who I am? And so we look at, ideally, at the qualities of the soul. In the way that we dress ourselves physically, spiritually, we dress our soul in clothing as well, if you will, such as the clothing of honor and humility and so forth, yes? And so it's great to be able to explore one's own personal journey in those areas and maybe decide, this year I'm going to focus on these particular elements to be better. Maybe for me, it would be good to look at humility. And I've studied humility. The way we do it traditionally within our faith is to actually study work on humility, understand what humility means, and then maybe have a mantra and follow that up with some kind of journaling to see the result. So the idea is not just to talk about it or say, I'm going to do this, but actually do it. So if I can use humility as an example, anava is the Hebrew term for humility. It is not about being humble, and it's not about being haughty. It's the balance. There's an author and teacher and creator of a website called the Messiah Institute, who talks about this, Alan Morenas. Alan's an interesting character, and he's written a number of books on Musar, on the qualities of the soul. And in the book, he's written on humility as an example, and he describes it as if you're walking in the park. So if you imagine, you're walking in the park, and there's a park bench, and you've decided to go and sit on the bench for a minute. So the question, when you get to the park bench, do you get over there and do you spread yourself out as far as you can on the bench, take as much space as you possibly can? Or do you go over there and you sort of scooch over to the absolute edge and take as little space as possible? Or do you simply sit in the space that you need to sit in to be in that space? That's humility. And he even created a mantra that I worked with for quite a period. And the mantra is, no more than my space, no less than my place. And the idea was to write the mantra, look at the mantra each day in order to start your day. So in the morning, as a Jew, I was brought up to say this prayer. When we open our eyes, we're supposed to say, Modeh ani lefanecha. Okay? Anyway, beautiful prayer with a great melody, and it's really saying, I am grateful to you, divine presence, for bringing me to this day. How are you doing, and what can I do to serve you better today? Essentially, that's what Modani means. And so you do that, you look at your mantra, and then you go about your day with that in mind. And at the end of the day, you have a journal by your bedside, and you write a few notes. How was your day impacted? How were people impacted by you as a result? What did you experience from that? And I found it to be very effective. So that's what we're really doing at this Yamim Noraim and these days of awe, is we're becoming much more conscious of ourselves, of our purpose, of taking our space. And it says that on Rosh Hashanah, the decision of your fate for the year is made by the heavenly court. So it's a visual that one takes with one. The idea being, okay, so we're going to be decided upon, as Leonard Cohen wrote in one of his songs, Who by Fire? Who's going to live? Who's going to die? And how is that going to happen? And what can we do to influence the time that we have to do better? And that's decided on Rosh Hashanah, and in Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, it is sealed. From that point on, in other words, you can't just keep changing your mind, make a decision, go with it, and then live it to the fullest. That's kind of how Yom Kippur works. And on Yom Kippur, I mean, people talk about, well, Yom Kippur, don't you fast for 25 hours? And the answer is, yes, we do. And it's really interesting how many Jews, the majority of whom are not observant religious but would identify themselves as secular Jews, a cultural Catholic, there are secular Jews who would not attend regular religious services, but they show up for Yom Kippur and possibly even for Rosh Hashanah. It's really interesting. The idea is as well on that period, in that period, and the reason we fast is it's not because there's, you know, we're in mourning or anything like that, but the idea is if you're truly doing an accounting of the soul, if you're really going in there and really doing this final sort of accounting with the heavenly host and, you know, where you want to be in this and that you want that extra year because you're going to do great stuff, you really don't have time to think about anything else. Food is irrelevant. Drink is irrelevant. For the sake of 25 hours, we can forsake that and just focus on what we want to achieve here. That's the essence of that. And traditionally at Yom Kippur, between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, Jews will go asking for forgiveness. If I did something that offended you, on purpose, inadvertently, whatever, I will try to bring everything in me with sincerity and ask for your forgiveness so that I can't do it again. In fact, if there was something that you can elucidate, bring it to me and let's do this. Let's do the tikkun, let's do the repair, and I'll ask your forgiveness on that basis. And it is incumbent on the other to forgive wholeheartedly. Otherwise, don't bother, right? It's really very, very beautiful concept in living well in community. trying to let go of past hurts. It doesn't mean to say that you weren't hurt, and it doesn't mean to say that it wasn't important, and it wasn't meaningful, and it wasn't bad. All of those things apply, but we need to move forward. How can we do that? And how can we do that well? Those are the essential concepts behind Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah. And essentially, Yom Kippur, that day, is between the individual and God, if you will, his spiritual intent. But we use that as an opportunity to do this with community as well. Anything we do that's forgiven in Yom Kippur, you know, between me and God, does not forgive me for anything I did to a fellow human being. So we still have to do that work. Okay? So that's how it works. I hope I didn't speak too long so far. Do you have questions? Yes. Oh, right. Okay, thank you.
Thanks. So you brought up the condition of humility. So is there kind of a catalog of, you know, beatitudes or something like that, states you want to encourage? And if there is, it, like, you have talked about readings and so forth and practices. Are they somehow, I don't know, systematized? Like, people can say, yeah, I'm going to pick kindness or something, and I'll work on that, and I have certain texts I can work with,
yes,
or certain writers and stuff like that?
Absolutely. There are famous rabbis who have written on these qualities, and we actually will study them in Hebrew and English text, and debate them and discuss them, so that they become something that we become intimate with. If you're going to do this, if you're really going to explore your qualities, one of them is anger. If one has a tendency towards anger, and you want to do something about it, how do you address that? What would be meaningful, practical ways to do that? The first thing is to discuss it, to analyze it, to read texts about people who have experienced that and the results of those things, if you see what I mean. There was a famous two rabbis, Rabbi Eliezer and Reish Lakish, who's one of my favorite sages of the early temple times. Reish Lakish, I love him. He's a rabbi who sat in the Sanhedrin, which was the court of, you know, where they made decisions on questions that were asked of law. And he was a highway robber who left those ways and became learned and then became a rabbi. And his study partner, in Judaism, the first requirement of all Jews is find a study partner and then find a rabbi to study with. In other words, if you want to actually learn, you can't do it in isolation. And he studied with this other rabbi who was this Talmudic scholar of great renown. They had this argument that became quite bitter. And the great rabbi said something that was really hurtful to Reish Lakish. He walked away, he got sick, and eventually he died. And this great rabbi went into a total depression. And his students, after a time, were trying to bring him out of the depression, and they just couldn't get him. In the end, they had this great idea. Okay, obviously he's missing his study partner. So they went around and they found these incredibly brilliant study partners. And one at a time, they brought them to this rabbi to study with him. And it had no impact. It was like unaffected by this. So eventually, in frustration, they went to him and they said, we don't understand. We know that you guys studied together as partners for all this period, but these are great rabbis who would have challenged, I mean, they were on your level of intellect. He said, exactly. Whatever I said, they agreed with me. When Reish Lakish and I studied together, he gave me 25 reasons why he didn't agree with me. And then we were able to study and go deeper and learn something, right? So you study these things and you learn about the good and the bad of anger, you know, the good and the bad of being humble or haughty. If you're humble, one way of dealing with humbleness in a practical sense, go put on the brightest dress you have and sit right in the front when you go to a conference. And if you're haughty, wear something very plain and sit in the back. Kind of idea like that. Put yourself through a process. Does that help to...
atonement is a major part of this, yes? Yeah. And it seems to me that it might be a difficult concept for children to grasp. So I'm wondering, how do you work with children? How do you start with them to lead them through, or whatever it is you do?
That's a really good question. And the answer is very simply. So it's a simple process. For us, it's about using simple examples in their own lives and saying, okay, so you just got angry with about this. Remember when you did that? How did that make you feel? How did that make that, your friend feel, for example? And how will you deal with that? What will you do with that? And so we follow just the simple basic process of effect and consequences, etc. And it seems to work quite well, actually, with the children. So we also have, I mean, in our community, we don't have a lot of kids present in services. But when we do, we have a junior congregation. And there we will have a much more simplified process and offer the children an opportunity for interactive encounter with their spirituality and with these, you know, sort of at that level. Seems to work quite well.
So you ask them to think about others?
Yes. Yes. From a Jewish perspective, it's not about what the other did wrong. It's about how can you be better. Maimonides, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, who's a famous philosopher, teacher, rabbi from the 11th century, lived in Cordova, Spain, and then came to Egypt and was a physician to the kings of Egypt in Alexandria, and still did pro bono for his community in Cairo. One of the things that he said was, imagine that the world is in perfect balance, and the next thing you do will tip the scales one way or the other. Thanks very much. No pressure. but it makes the point.
Yes, thank you for this presentation today, and I'm so glad that we have a chance to ask you some questions and so forth too. I'm really aware of the tradition in the Jewish faith to seek meaning. And I was fascinated by your talking about a study partner and then finding a rabbi. And, you know, in that way, actually, learning takes place. And also the example of the fellow who, the rabbi who the other rabbis would agree with, but he really liked someone that didn't agree with him, and the argument would be set up and then deepening of understanding. Now, I'd really like to ask you how that plays out in everyday contemporary life. Like, is that, what proportion of Jewish people are probably actually engaged in this tradition? You know, and where does it take place? Children's education program, or just in schools that are Jewish schools, or, okay, I just want to know. Play it through for me.
Okay. It's an interesting question. First of all, I can tell you in Israel, it's an everyday fact of life. That's how we exist. To give you an example, I was in Eilat in Israel a number of years ago with my wife, and she found a shop as we were walking down the main boulevard there that had her favorite designer clearance. And so she wanted to go in and check the clothing that was on clearance, on sale. And so we went into the store, and the salesman came over, and they were designer clothes. There was no way even at clearance prices that she was going to afford it. But he took her over, he asked her, and she said, I was looking at this. And he said, well, look, let me show you. So he showed her the stuff, and he saw that I was wearing a kippah, because not everybody's wearing a kippah in Israel, and obviously I'm not Israeli. So he asked me where I was from and why I was wearing a kippah, and I told him that I'm a rabbi. And he said, well, you know, I'm not a religious man, but... And we got into this conversation about the Bible, about Torah. We ended up sitting at a table while my wife looked at clothing, discussing and debating certain areas of Torah, and got into an argument, a really good argument about certain aspects. At one point, his manager came over and said, what are you doing? And he said, I'm just talking to the rabbi here. I got some discussion. We're having an argument about this case. And he said, oh, okay, no problem. And then he went on. I don't know anywhere else in the world where that would happen. I just don't. So anyone who's brought up in a Jewish tradition is likely going to have that kind of attitude towards just about everything. I think it's a great attitude to have. Although you can take it too far. You can do what happened to Rish Lakish. The key is to maybe be able to keep it collegial. And even when I studied for the rabbinate, in our seminary, we would go into these study halls at night. So we'd have a class during the day, two classes at the day, and then in the evening we went into study hall till quite late. And that was the format. We would take a piece of scripture and we would argue the scripture. And you could, the noise from the arguments. I mean, people, we get passionate about this stuff. And then afterwards we'd have a great time drinking and, you know, having snacks. But the richness of what you get from that is amazing. And my biggest concern today is that we're still, although the paradigm shift is happening, we still tend to live in a world that's somewhat autonomous, certainly at the education level in our classrooms. There's still a lot of do as you're told, this is the answer, this is the curriculum that I think you need to learn, therefore that's what you'll learn, as opposed to a critical inquiry process. So, okay, a quick example. How am I doing? Is this okay? Yeah, okay. A quick example. I have bar mitzvah classes. I teach children for their bar mitzvah, for their coming of age at 12 and 13, 12 for a girl, 13 for a boy. I started a new curriculum a few years ago. I hand each child, when they join me, each young adult, a blank page. That's the curriculum. And they now have to write all of the questions that they would like answers to about Judaism, about God, about spirituality, all of those things. And the, for the next year, our discussions are on those questions. And I don't give them the answers. They have to find the answers. As a teacher, my job is to direct them, give them direction, is to guide them, if you will, is to engage them. But in the end, I want them to lead the process as far as they can. Because then it's meaningful to them. It's been a very successful program. Hang on 1 second.
It seems that in the argument and even in the what you were saying about handing the children a blank page and they find the answers to their questions, it seems to me that the winning or getting the right answer doesn't seem to be the object. It seems the exploration is the object in understanding broadly, not just as one thing, but the implications, the nuances are all there if you've explored it.
Not seeming, that's it, that's the point.
The exploration.
The question is more important than the answer. Let me put it to you that way, from my perspective.
Yeah, but what can be seen as a confrontational activity, if you're looking for a winner and loser, you've got them in many things in life, but if you just looked at that same activity a little bit differently,
exactly.
As we now know more, we can look at the whole picture instead of just looking at this one thing.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. You got it. And it works.
Yeah, I learned something from my granddaughters this last weekend about atonement. I don't see them all that much, so I don't know all their little rituals of getting along together. The 3, 10, 8, 6, and the 10, I was babysitting them, and 10 and 8-year-old fell out. So they were sort of ignoring each other and angry, and other things were happening. And then about 15 minutes later, one said to the other, hug, and the other one smiled, and they hugged. And I imagine that must be their ritual for atonement.
It sounds
so
like
I learned something from them.
Wow. Very cool. That's beautiful.
Is there anyone else that has? David?
It's sort of a comment about your presentation. We've had a recent presentation was by a Wiccan person, and her point of view was like, here's what we do, and you know, there are these things and we do practices and stuff. And it was, to me, it was kind of, okay, here's one more interesting religion. Whereas your presentation is actually about more fundamental thinking in your religion, in your religious practice. And I think that's very valuable to anybody, especially us. I mean, you know, we're all thinking about religions or non-religious and practices and, you know, life issues. So I really want to thank you for the way you presented and discussed what you did. It wasn't about, you know, we have these sayings and we have these practices. It's really about how we work with, you know, big questions. Have you ever thought about having sort of a, I don't know what, like a webinar or something about different aspects of Judaism, just for people of, you know, I'm not sure whom it would be for, but this kind of thing about different aspects of Judaism might be really valuable.
No, I haven't, but it's an interesting idea. It would be interesting to explore those possibilities. I think that you mentioned a Wiccan person speaking. My sense is that certainly with something like Wiccan, it is seen as somewhat of a fringe belief system, and maybe looked at by convention as being kind of out there or questionable or whatever. And so I wonder how often people engaged in that area find themselves feeling almost apologetic about what they do, or looking to try and sort of find a, say, this is what we do, and it's, do you know what I mean? It would be great if we were able to just allow them to be in the room and let's have a conversation, right? I would be curious and interested to learn more. Thank you for that comment, by the way, because that's helpful to me. It's a thought.
Yes, I'm just wondering, what's the difference between the Ashkenazi Jews and the Sephardi Jews? And is there a significant difference in their religious view of the world?
Good question. Okay, so the primary difference between Ashkenazim and Sephardim, Sephardi Jews come from either Spain, Portugal, Italy, France even, and the Middle East, Middle Eastern countries, and the Ashkenazim come primarily from Eastern Europe originally. So when they were dispersed into, you know, when Jews were dispersed into the diaspora, they ended up living in all parts of the world. They would have been influenced by the cultures in which they lived. You can hear it in the music. You can hear it in the pronunciation of words. So Sephardim speak more like I'm speaking right now, and the Ashkenazim don't. They have a different pronunciation to their words. But most of, I mean, I can go to any synagogue anywhere in the world and pick up any prayer book and pretty well figure out where we are in the service. And it may be difficult for Ashkenazim to do that within a Sephardi service because there may be a few extra prayers that they don't normally have, or some that they don't have that have been taken out or whatever. The difficulty will be in the ear, the pronunciation. Sort of like if you're speaking to someone who's Cockney versus someone who comes from the West End of London, I guess. It might be difficult for them to, it'll take a while for the ear to attune. And the melodies are going to be different, right? But that aside, the basic structure of our services are the same everywhere, interestingly enough. And there's been a bit of crossover of some of the melodies. There's a melody on the Day of Atonement, at the end, the last service, the last of the five services for that day, called Ne'ilah. And it's the, you know, that's when the gates are closing and we're doing our final sort of atoning. And it's a very, but it's also a very uplifting. And we begin the service with this beautiful piece, this piyut, a poem that was written by a Sephardi rabbi in the, I think it was approximately 1400s. And the melody is a Sephardi melody that is now being adopted more and more and has been adopted more and more by Ashkenazi as well as Sephardi synagogues. And it's not surprising. It's this beautiful... Eleanor Alila, Eleanor Alila, Hamtzilanu Meisha, Veshata Ne'ila, la 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 la. It's just beautiful, you know. So after a whole day and, you know, the night before as well, 25 hours of fasting, we're coming to the end. This just gives you this pump of energy that really sort of takes you to the sort of the finishing line, if you will. Sorry? Some communities do. A lot of communities are very stiff. We're still so conventional and caught up with ego and so forth that it's hard for people to get out of their seats and really throw themselves into prayer. I actually teach a class on prayer. And my opening salvo is, you can't teach prayer, you have to do prayer. And I'm teaching it, which is kind of interesting. But it's true. So those are the sorts of things that, and we're starting to share more and more of those things, which is lovely. Now, I happen to come from both traditions. So for me, it's just a pleasure to be able to pick from wherever I want.
Maybe one last question.
You come from both traditions. Could you expand on that, please?
Sure. My father and his family are originally from Belarus, when Belarus was geographically a part of Poland. And my mother's mother and her family came from Berlin. Both are Ashkenazim. Her father, my grandfather on my mother's side, was Sephardim. A Sephard. He was a Sephardi Jew, and he lived, he actually imported cigars from Cuba at one point, which was kind of interesting, but he was from Spain. And so, and just to sort of top it off, the family synagogue is in St. John's Wood, London, where the last chief rabbi, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, that's his synagogue as well, and that's a strong Orthodox Ashkenazi synagogue. But I sang in the choir next to our house of the Spanish and Portuguese synagogue in Lauderdale Road, which is a Sephardi synagogue. So I was exposed to both traditions growing up, which was great. I mean, what an advantage. So.
One more.
But it's the encore.
Because we've been doing work around reconciliation, and that word is being used widely in Canadian society these days, really, can you, you know, talk about reconciliation and atonement?
Yeah. Well, I think you start by talking about it. And maybe what we do is we pay lip service to it initially. I mean, I think that's just the human way, the human nature. I had the privilege of speaking at the prayer breakfast in April, talking about building Regina and Canada anew, because the makeup, the demographic of our world here in Canada and in Regina is no longer what it used to be. In recent years, the diversity is far greater. The Luther High School recognizes 30 different cultures and faiths within their student body, as an example. And so the answer to that, for me, biblically, because I always go for community development and community response to these concerns and questions, is what does the Torah say? For me, it's the Torah. That's the how-to book on how to live well in community. And there's this beautiful example of the Israelites from the beginning, right from, we just started reading it again, from Abraham on, right, of people behaving badly, doing bad things, and so on, and constantly arguing, complaining. When they left Egypt, there was nothing but complaints. Right? Why did you bring us here? This water's bitter. Why get us back to Egypt? At least there we ate. And so on and so on and so on. Until Moses does this amazing leadership move. He makes this move. The move is, bring the best that you have, gold, silver, fabric, the best that you have, and we will build together a place where God's Spirit can actually live among us. For the next 500 verses in the Torah, there is not a single complaint. Not a one. And I actually saw that at Habitat for Humanity. Same thing. Every time we did a build, never a complaint. People just got along and got the job done. We need, as Canadians, to rebuild Canada the same way. We need to take a common task, all of us together. Our First Nations and Indigenous peoples, our peoples, from wherever they've come, and build that, right? Spoke to that. everybody was in accord. It was a good, if I say so myself, I got it across. It went well. And then the following week, one of the Islamic community had made a motion, had put forward a request to buy a property in order to build a mosque. And they found a way to not let it go through. And I have to tell you, I was terribly disheartened. I spoke this and saw that. And then I reminded myself, you got to keep talking it. It will come round. We just need time. And so atonement is all about that. That's why we talk about mantras. It's why we talk about reminding ourselves all the time, because we forget. We get up in the morning, you go do say a nice prayer, right? You just came here to do some beautiful community, common unity, to do things together. And someone's going to get in the car and they're going to get cut off in traffic, and guess what's going to happen? Right? That's okay. We're just human. We just got to keep at it. So reconciliation, atonement, they very much go hand in hand. But I will tell you this, and I've told it to my congregation many times. When you read the first page of the evening service of the Day of Atonement, in the Kol Nidre service, at the bottom of the first page, it says, Salachti kidvarecha, I have already forgiven you. Page one. Somebody said to me, well, if he's already forgiven us, why are we going to go through 25 hours of fasting? And the answer, of course, is because God doesn't need it. We need it. That's the whole point. But we'll get there. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.